watched over by buzzing cyborg menials pacing the steep lip. The children stood in a single file that stretched dead straight all the way back to the birthing chambers, now many, many miles away. When Call turned back, he could see a row of bald heads disappearing into the distance. Call turned forwards, and the same line continued on a short distance before being abruptly cut off by a wall in which were set three doors. He had seen little of the world. Though he appeared to be about 10 years of age, he was only hours old, fast grown in the Xanthe Terra flesh vats of Magos Biologis Hammereth. There were children born on Mars in the time-honored way. That was, after all, the initial design the machine god had chosen for mankind. But the higher tech priests had no time to waste on something so trivial as procreation. The machine god had created man so that he might improve himself. This information and more had been inloaded during Call's gestation, but his direct experience of life was confined to ejection from the tube, the unpleasant aftermath of that, the trench, the line, and the stripe of sky framed by metal walls. The sky was burnt orange, full of enormous shapes and moving machines half obscured by clouds of drifting smog. The air tasted of thousands of years of industry. Metallic, chemical smells burned his throat. It was wholly unpleasant, and he wished he did not have to experience it. Already he knew there were ways to remove that sensation, if he chose. Built out from the side of the trench, in front of the doors, was a pulpit occupied by something that had once been a man. A mountain of cable-infested flesh, graced with many arms, the man wore a tall pointed hat, beneath which three lenses framed in brass evaluated each child in turn. A tube went from his mouth into the workings of his pulpit. The lenses and the tube were his sole facial features. Thin scraps of oil-seamed skin held them together. Pistons forced open the rightmost gate, and a child stepped through. The man made a note in a ledger on the lectern of his pulpit, then turned his attention to the next child. The children stepped one at a time to stand beneath his quivering bulk. Multiple mechanical arms shot out from all sides and prodded and probed the child, dusting them with telltale chemicals, sampling blood and spittle, testing eye pressure, blood pressure, heart rate, digestive efficiency, and more. Light rays, visible and invisible, fanned out and swept down their skin. Sonar pulses vibrated bones. Magnetism stirred tides in their humors. X-rays flashed the silhouettes of their skeletons into data stores that would never be looked at. Buzz, clank, hiss, bang, the machine sang.
"Next, supplicant," the man said.
Buzz, clank, hiss, bang. One of the three gates opened, representing, Call already knew, the threefold nature of his god. Machine god, omnisire, and the motive force. Buzz, clank, hiss, bang.
"Next, supplicant."
The left gate opened, the right gate opened, funneling off children to their algorithmically determined fates. Rarely did the center gate part. When it did, a man wrote a little more in his book.
"Next, supplicant."
Buzz, clank, hiss, bang. The right gate opened. The child stepped wordlessly through. It was Call's turn.
"Next, supplicant."
Call stepped forwards. The machines on arms whisked around him on their mysterious errands.
"Who are you?"
Call asked. The man leaned forwards to peer down at him over the edge of his ledger.
"You speak?"
"I speak. Language has been force implanted in my mind."
"The others do not speak,"
said the man, in equal parts query, challenge, and demand that Call be silent.
"My given designation is Belisarius Call," he said.
"The others do not speak. They are not ready to speak. Observe."
One of the man's many supplemental limbs lifted. The child behind Call went rigid. A stream of nonsense babbled from their mouth.
"Beinharic, of the fourth formation," Call said. "They do not have the correct machinery to emit it correctly. Only this."
He rubbed his throat with the blade of his hand.
"This is not sufficient. Upgrade is required. I suppose it will do for now."
Emotionless red lenses peered at him for a long time. The man made a noise in his throat that hummed in the tube plugging his mouth.
"You are precocious, aren't you?"
his voxmitter rumbled.
"You are a manifestation of the machine god, but you are not he. Where is he? Where is my father?"
The arms froze, then retracted a little.
Said
the man. The center doors clashed open. Call looked at them, then at the man. He did not move.
Proceed or die, the man said.
Call stepped through.
Next supplicant,
the tech priest said, settling a little into his throne. There was no one ahead of Call in the middle channel. The gates shut hard.
Bang!
Circa 11,000 years ago. The last sign of human life Ezekiel Sedain encountered nearly killed him. A cracking in the air far away, the whine of a bullet, the screech of ricochet. He threw himself into the grit at the sound of the gunshot. It rumbled around the stony desolation of the valley before taking flight to disappear over the mountains. He lay there some time. No other shot came. He rose only when the sky began to dim and the temperature drop. Glancing nervously over his shoulder, he scrambled up the loose rock. Darkness fell quickly that time of year. By the time he had found a path, it was pitch black, and the cold began to bite. Men died in the mountains in autumn, succumbing to the chill more often than to the hill clans who dwelled in the hollow ruins of our colleges found all through the peaks. In the square caves of old rooms, fires burned, but none were close to Sedain, so he struggled on through the night. The way was perilous. He nearly lost his footing twice, but he dared not risk a light. Night passed slowly. Stars wheeled overhead. The arcologies fell behind him, until by morning he was walking through glens of bare rock, surrounded by the bald, wrinkled heads of the Alapi. Ancient roads went nowhere. Time-worn stones marked the graves of buildings. There were no signs of human life more recent than these. Nothing and no one lived in the blasted wasteland, only the Master of the Lines. What Sedain attempted was an incredible risk. The Master of the Lines came to the people. The people did not go to him, not if they wanted to live. The sun came up on a landscape glittering with frost. Sedain could not feel his feet or his fingers. His rags were scant protection against mountain cold. He breakfasted on a mouthful of brackish water. He swilled his canteen around. It sloshed loudly. There was more air than water within. The sun rose, pitilessly bright, piteously cold. The protective layers of the upper atmosphere were thin so far north, and he felt his skin begin to blister. He adjusted the ragged hood he wore, pulling it to shade more of his face, then pushed on. A mountain rose above him. Each step he took raised it higher, it seemed to Sedain, so that in no time it barred his path completely, walling off the glen with crags of rock that resembled angry faces. Bare stone reflected weak, poisonous sunlight upon him, dazzling his eyes and burning his cheeks. He raised his canteen to his lips, the metal edge finding cracked, painful skin there, and drank down the last of his water. There was nowhere to get more. He was too far on to turn back. He must either complete his journey or die. Resolutely, he began his ascent. Up the mountain went. Up, too, went Sedain. The air thinned. Each breath brought less oxygen to his body, no matter how deep he gulped it in. He knew before he got halfway up that he was running out of time. He tasted blood in his mouth with every breath. His tongue was a parched scrap of leather. His lips stung. His cheeks burned. The mountain was taking everything from him, and still it towered overhead, featureless, grey, and deadly. He rounded a boulder that forced his path into a brittle ribbon of stone. It got narrower and narrower, so that his toes stubbed on solid rock and his heels hung over empty space. The boulder was fat-bellied, swelling as the path thinned. He was forced to lean back, clinging to the boulder with fingertips rubbed raw and to the path with toes numb with pressure. His strength was giving out. He was on the verge of falling backwards into the open air and to certain death on the tumbled stones below, when the path suddenly swung into the body of the mountain again, and the boulder's swelling blended itself back into the cliff. He staggered towards a shadow, arms outstretched to brace himself against the wall and rest, but found himself instead falling forwards, for the shadow was not a shadow after all, but a cave cracked into the mountain's flank. It took a steep turn downwards. His feet found no purchase, forcing him into an ungainly rush to keep pace with his toppling body. His hand hit cold stone, bending it painfully. His elbow folded and his shoulder connected with hard rock. He stumbled sideways with a twist in the passage. Blackness shrank back to small refuges. Orange light danced on the angles of the stone. The tunnel became a cavern. A fire burned in its center. An old man squatted at the side, dangerously close, peering into the flame so intensely his beard and eyebrows were at risk of ignition. Despite the cold of the stone and the heat of the fire, the old man was practically naked, with only worn sandals on his feet and a cloth about his waist. There was a stone trough full of water to the side. Sedain took a moment to refill his canteen. He drank some, washing the dust from his throat so he could speak. Still panting with the altitude, Sedain approached the fire.
"I have come far," he said.
"What do you want?" said the old man.
He kept his eyes on the flames and did not blink.
"You are the one that purifies the blood of the lines?"
"I am not," said the man. "Is that why you are here, to plead for genomancy so your line runs true? You are young to seek to birth a child, and the next purity fair is not for 6 months. Go back down the mountain. Choose your mate. Wait. Come to the master at the fair."
His eyes flicked up.
"If you survive."
He went back to looking at the fire.
"I do not wish to mate. I do not come to plead for purity of my line."
"Oh," said the man. "Then tell me, why are you here?"
"To learn."
Sedain knelt down to face the man.
"Teach me."
"Teach you?"
"I want to be like you. I want to learn the old sciences."
"The old sciences are not for learning, not for the likes of you," said the old man. "Begone."
"I will die. Have mercy. I've searched for lost knowledge. I have learned much. I can learn more."
"Feeble pleas for deaf ears," said the old man. "I shall not let you pass. The master will not see you."
"The world is broken. There is knowledge that can help. I'm no fool. Life hasn't always been this way. There are stories of the old world and of the Empire of Stars."
"There are. They are stories."
"They are true,"
said Sedain through gritted teeth.
"Are they?" said the old man. "Maybe they are. That does not make your case any more compelling. You will leave now or perish. Take your chances on the mountain."
"I want to help people."
Sedain moved closer. He was a big man, and he loomed over the sentinel. The man produced a small gun from a pool of shadow on the floor. It was better made than any Sedain had ever seen. He looked up at Sedain.
"Healing was only one of the masteries of the old world. Death they also perfected. Go, or you will learn but one final lesson."
"Selfishness is why the human race is dying," he said. "I sought wisdom here. It appears I was mistaken."
The old man returned his attention to the fire.
"Damn you, by the old gods of all the ages of men," said Sedain.
"To make it this far, you must have a measure of wisdom already," the old man said. "Use it well."
Sedain felt his way away from the fire and back up the tunnel. Another freezing night awaited him. He emerged into darkness, glanced back, and headed for the boulder, unsure if he had the energy to make it around to the other side safely.
"Wait,"
a voice spoke, a voice he heard in his mind. He turned rapidly, almost losing balance. The path continued past the cave crack, perhaps a way worn into the stone by animals long extinct, certainly nothing more than that, but on it stood a man in rich clothes. He had long, clean, brown hair, a face that was at once youthful and old, and eyes of placid brown deeper than time. It was past twilight, and yet Sedain saw him clearly, as if he stood in a patch of noon, special to him alone.
"Wait,"
said the man again, aloud this time.
"Who are you?"
said Sedain, in wonder. For some ridiculous reason, he felt the urge to kneel.
"I am the one you call the Master of the Lines, he who ensures purity of blood and genes among the peoples of this region." "You do not look like him."
"I look different, if the need arises."
"Is deception necessary?"
"Sometimes, yes. But I show myself to you truthfully."
"That is not all you are, I think."
Sedain had never been surer of anything in his life.
"I am not. I am more."
"Who are you?"
"Someone who wants to help people like you, Ezekiel Sedain. You were sincere when you said those same words in the cave. Do you sense the same sincerity in me?
He did. He didn't know how, but he did.
Yes, he said. Then will you serve me? I will teach you what you wish to learn. You will be of great value to me, many times over, if you accept. You will be of great value to humanity.
Tell me who you are, first. I cannot serve a man who hides his identity, not unless there is good reason.
There is good reason.
There is good reason for my request as well, said Sedain. Humor me.
I have many names, but in time I will be known as the Emperor of Mankind, the man said.
As he said it, Sedain had a brief but terrifying flash of a being who could crush him out of existence with a single thought, and that was only the least of his abilities. Nevertheless, Sedain stood his ground.
The Emperor?
Yes.
The Emperor smiled, as if his title were a private joke between friends. Sedain's laughter echoed from the dead mountains.
There is only anarchy. Warlords, the carrion feeders who flock around them and the people they devour. There are no emperors and no empires, no kings or kingdoms, no governance, just or cruel, not now. There is only death.
There are no kingdoms yet, agreed the Emperor. My title is for a realm yet to come, a glorious place. If you serve me, you will help to bring it into being. You will know the peace you yearn for. You will know a better world.
I wish to help people, said Sedain. My comfort is incidental.
A wish to help and a wish for safety are not mutually exclusive, Ezekiel. You need have no secrets from me. You cannot have secrets from me. Be calm. I see nothing ill in you. Will you serve me?
Yes.
The Emperor smiled. He had expected no other answer.
Then I have wonders to show you. The great work begins now.
Call and Sedain. Sedain and Call. The two merged and fought like competing currents in a turbulent sea, both indivisible yet clearly at war, a paradox in the making. Call remembered. Sedain remembered. They both saw what the other saw and felt what the other felt. The proscribed technologies of Diocomedes, so innocuously housed in the casings of the room, purred and hummed, pulling up on the hidden dimension of the warp. Call knew then that this was no simple merging of minds, but a blending of souls. Consequently, he felt, as Sedain felt, a growth in power alongside a diminishment of individuality. Sedain was old. So many years had passed since he had first encountered the Master of Mankind that they ceased to have a meaning beyond marks on a calendar. Call had lived a fraction of that time. The depths of Sedain's knowledge and experience were such that Call's brilliant but young mind was swamped by Sedain's, swallowed up like a tear in a downpour.
I am sorry. I am sorry, Sedain thought.
And so Call thought. Sedain meant it. His intentions were pure, after a fashion, and his sorrow hurt Call as if it were his own, for now it was, as were all his memories, and his knowledge, and his power. It was too much, too much, too much. Call was dwindling away, absorbed by the being of Sedain.
I am sorry, said Sedain.
Bang! Somewhere, somewhen, a sheet of metal clashed upon a rock. Like a drowning man, Call grasped for it, though in the raging storm of their merging souls, it might well have dashed him to pieces.
Bang!
Call opened his eyes, Sedain's eyes. He was on the bridge in other mountains, far from the Alapi. Centuries separated the two memories, but memory is wise to time's illusion, and nothing separated them at all. One room was exited, and another entered.
Belisarius Call, said the Emperor.
Confused by the name, Sedain looked upon his hands. They were old and veined already. Decades of war lay between this moment and the moment that saw Kaul and Sedain inside the engines of Diocomedes. Another room in time. Another door that could be opened at will by the speaker.
"My name is Ezekiel Sedain," said Sedain.
"For now," agreed the Emperor.
The Emperor was by his side at the bridge's parapet. Kaul, or was it Sedain, trembled as he looked upon him, but he appeared unremarkable, as he often did. His long hair was tied back. He wore a scientist's white, crisp garb. He was not tall, and nor was he short. He was handsome, but not outrageously so. Slight, but not thin. An unremarkable being, were it not for the terrifying sense of power that radiated from him, as untamed as the heart of a star. Sedain felt fuzzy. The working of time demands that memories of the future be hard to hold, and they slipped away. Why had he come out there?
"To rest," he said aloud.
But he did not remember what he was doing before he came to the bridge.
"You are the Emperor," said Kaul.
"Or Sedain. Or both of them."
"I am," said the Emperor. "Am I meeting you?" "You have met me many times, Belisarius," said the Emperor. "But not as..."
He frowned a frown on Sedain's face. It was a younger face, but still old.
"But not as me, in a manner of speaking."
The Emperor looked at him sidelong.
"In another manner, you are Ezekiel Sedain, and always have been, and Kaul is a fragment, an artifact left behind by a desperate man's attempt to stay alive." "That hasn't happened yet," said Kaul. "When is this?" "Every moment. No moment. A moment gone. Nothing ever passes, not truly, but goes only beyond notice." "Ah," said Kaul, or Sedain. "You are free of this. Is that so?"
"No one is free of time," said the Emperor. "Not even me. As long lived as I am, it is ironic that the one thing I lack is time."
The Emperor frowned.
"There is never enough. Is this a dream within a dream? A dream remembered? Or did this really happen?" asked Kaul.
The Emperor laughed. It was a sound as terrible as avalanches thundering down mountainsides.
"Is there any difference between those things?" "Are you always this frustratingly gnomic?" said Kaul. "Because, to be frank, it is a little disappointing."
The Emperor laughed again, with genuine mirth.
"I do like you, Belisarius, though many do not. But it is not your duty to be popular. It is to be important. Every dream is a reality somewhere. Know this, Belisarius Kaul. I will need you. You will think you have betrayed me. You will not in the end." "What are you talking about? You are the Omnissiah. I could never betray you." "You will," said the Emperor sadly. "But you will be right to. You will not again." "Does Sedain remember this conversation?" "Foresight is not a steady friend, Belisarius. One day it may strike with startling clarity. For centuries, it is only a feeling. This is a good day." "Did this really happen?"
The Emperor smiled again.
"I am really here."
Bang! The metal hit the stone. Their fight was not over, and never would be. Now.
"This is who you are," said the voice of the mountain. "Impure, blended, not one creature, not two, many. A poisonous slick of spirits cased in meat and clumsy technology. Pathetic." "I am not unique in this regard," said Kaul.
He was nowhere again, in a place that existed yet that had no physical domain. He was within the infosphere of the mountain, and the mind imprisoned by the machine encompassed him.
"Mental enhancement within my subset of my species is often attained by cortical linkage.
There are therefore many blended personalities. Other sections of humanity employ other methods, as do certain Xenos.
He spoke to the being over a network of quantum particles flashing in and out of existence. The tech was superior to any he had witnessed, greater in sophistication even than mankind's at the height of his power. Yet Call had a way in. Quietly, he began to exert more of his influence on the mechanisms of the Pharos.
Everything living is unique. Uniqueness of creation and experience gives them their flavor.
The mountain's presence coiled round him, threatening to constrict at any moment.
Then I am unique in the breadth of my knowledge. There is no other like me in all the galaxy. If you wish to be free and to see your enemies scattered, then only I can help you, said Call.
His enhanced mind, now fully enwrapped about the mountain's polydimensional machine spirit, prepared its key.
We wonder what you would taste like. If you devour me, how can I serve you? You are afraid. All men are afraid, as are gods. You fear entrapment here forever.
Slowly, carefully, Call extended his cipher coding into the outer web of Xenos data. He felt a thrill of fear as he did so. These were always the escapades he enjoyed the most, the sneaking into the sleeping ogre's castle, the stealing of his treasures.
You dare guess our mind? You know nothing.
The presence reared, perturbing the chains of logic that held it within the infosphere as the beams of empirical energy trapped it in the physical world. Call froze his work, but only the being's pride was affronted. It had not detected his ploy.
We have seen your god. The waking networks of our treacherous children sing of him from one dynasty to the other. He is no god. He is nothing. There were other beings who had pretensions to divinity. They died. He will die. A being like he can cheat time. We transcend it. We are time and space and the bonds between. He is no god. We are. Then I beg you, please, Great One, reveal yourself to me. You have seen within my soul. You know that my mission here is pure. You know I can do what you require. I seek your knowledge. I pledge myself to serve you. I wish what you wish for. Together we can end the war that has corrupted space and time. We can purge the poison of chaos and return the great work of the Machine God to full order. That is all I desire. Order and calm and good function to all things.
There was a long silence. A millennia's worth of alien data raced past Call from hidden dimensions. The architecture of the Necron infosphere was perfect in every way and gloriously, multiply purposed. His own coding spread themselves out within the Pharos infosphere's defenses, meshing here, changing there, bringing all points of ingress under his control.
Yes, the material realm versus the psychic. The warp must be banished. We can give you such secrets. Do! Cried Call. Who else, if not I? Your children work towards this end, but they are clumsy. They have forgotten much of what you taught them. They cannot do it. You are trapped. Your siblings are broken and scattered. And you can repair the damage of millions of years? We think not. You are weak.
Torrents of alien data flashed around Call. He was so tempted to plunge into them right then. All he needed to do was fling open the doors and jump. The temptation was overwhelming. He paused. Something troubled him. Multiple copies of his intellect sped around the Pharos network. What he saw made him swear, a rich biological set of phrases long since gone from the Gothic tongue. The systems containing the being and guarding the Pharos's trove of data were one and the same. He was going to have to let it out.
I am strong, he said.
The presence ceased its spiraling.
We are similar. You are not yourself, and nor are we. You are a composite. We are a fragment. Be not mistaken. We have no special affection for you. This is our soul connection. But it is enough to convince us to spare you, call of the humans. You shall free us. You shall be rewarded. We are mighty enough to survive separation from the confinement of the Necrodermis. We shall journey the galaxy and join with our sundered parts. The Necrontyr will rue the day they chose to betray their gods. We gave them everything they wished for, and they killed us. They will pay.
The being's rage was cold, almost emotionless, expressed in the furious vibrations of atomic energies rather than through cruder chemical reaction.
For eons, we have been imprisoned within this mountain. For eons, we have plotted our revenge. 8 fragments of 8 gods were given over to slavery here. We consumed the others to survive. The Necrontyr are fools. They are arrogant. They kept too large a piece of us alive to power this nodal point of theirs. They will regret it, for we remember what we were, and what we will one day be again.
The infosphere's cascades of light stuttered. A different light took its place, a brassy starshine. From the night of the Nowhere Realm it shone, coalescing as the mountain spoke into a figure that had no shape, forcing Kall's mind to impose a form he could understand upon it. Arms, legs, a head, a torso forged of gold.
We are the ultimate manifestation of order. No logic or illogic can bind me.
It spoke now with a mouth that blazed with stolen sunlight.
We are Zahulash, the Potentate. We are Catan of the stars and the tides of time and light. We are the manifestation of this universe's form and being. We are the god, and you will serve me. Set me free. I require a moment,
Kall shouted into the being's effulgence.
I must subdue the things that hold you. I can release you no other way.
His infospherical probes poised to take control of the routines holding the Catan. At the same time, he primed his subminds to storm the walls of the Pharos' network. Both parts were inextricably linked. If he wished to access the mountain's secrets, both gates had to be taken down simultaneously.
You attempt to deceive us! Great one, I ask only to better serve you. The machines, they are attempting to prevent your release. I can help you.
A tense moment passed.
Let it be so, said Zahulash.
A door opened. Behind was a treasure of knowledge. But it was not his, not yet. Machine spirits guarded it. Things watched him with jealous eyes. He needed a little more time. The Catan could see the way out. He didn't have time, so he was going to have to make it.
Release us!
Points of green light fizzled into existence around Kall's slumped body, forming a network that grew in complication until he was completely enmeshed.
Step back, said Felix.
The mountain thrummed. The pattern sent out a burst of lines, each point sending links to dozens of others.
It looks like a stellar cartograph, said Felix. Look, this is Sotha. I'm sure of it.
A ball of light occupied Sotha's position at the center of the map. It glowed with increasing potency as the map continued to spread. The galaxy unrolled by points of light, billions and billions of them.
Every star in the galaxy, said Primus. This information will be incredibly valuable to Belisarius Kall, said Felix. There are more of these Nexus points, more Pharoses, hundreds of them.
A network of beacons appeared in the galaxy, each one large and bright. The mountain's vibration became a steady rumble. The other beacons glowed brighter, initiating a third increase in luminescence that spread out rays in all directions, linking beacon to beacon. The Pharos shook with building power. The growing light pushed back the dark past the sarcophagi, revealing signs of withering on the faces of the dead 7. The light fell on a crumpled form. Metal limbs bent out of shape, a head twisted around on the neck to stare over its back. legs part absorbed by the stone.
"Call servant," said Felix. "Quo 87.
Felix ignited the power field around his fist. Psi fire shone behind Primus's eye lenses.
"Call has betrayed us," said Felix.
Belisarius' call came awake with a shudder. The lights of his enhancements ignited. Where before they burned cool reds and blues, now all were uniformly green. His feet extended, clanking on Blackstone, pushing him up. He raised his arms and stretched, as if awoken from a well-deserved rest. His eyes were alive with the lurid glow of Necron technology. He grinned.
"Decimus! Primus! You made it down here!"
"What are you doing?" Felix demanded.
"All will be revealed. Do stop pointing that gun at me, Decimus. Whatever happens next, gentlemen, please refrain from firing at anything."
The mountain shook harder. The beams of light fixed on the sarcophagus flickered out.
"What have you done?" said Felix.
Primus, sensing danger to his master from the Tetrarch, shifted his attention to Felix.
"In there," said Call, pointing a metal finger at the sarcophagus, "is a star god of the Necron Forerunner race. It's not complete, but it is the largest shard I have yet encountered."
He frowned.
"It is incredibly dangerous."
Felix looked from priest to sarcophagus.
"The Catan," said Felix incredulously. "You are releasing a Catan."
Felix raised his gun.
"Do not threaten the Archmagos,"
said Primus, striding to interpose himself between Felix and Call.
"I am releasing him," said Call. "Right now. In fact, here he comes. Remember, no shooting, Decimus."
He held up an admonishing hand.
"This is a very delicate time. I nearly have what we came for. Some of what I'm about to do will look foolish. It is not."
"Call."
Primus moved closer to Felix.
"My master knows what he is doing, be assured," Primus said. "He is no traitor."
Blazing starlight speared from the sides of the coffin.
"You had better be right," said Felix.
The sarcophagus began to open. Chapter 24. The Last Child of Sotha. Circa 10,000 years ago. Thracian blinked, suddenly able to move. He lifted up his hands. His face was raw with fresh burns. It came as a surprise to him that he could not see from his left eye. He had the fleeting sense he should be elsewhere, in some other time, a thought quickly forgotten.
"You wish to know how we did it?"
Hannelore sat blearily in the interrogation chair, her uniform ragged. Her arms were bound behind her by heavy fetters that encased her hands completely. There was not a scrap of flesh on her, unmarked by the confessor's goads. Burns, bruises, cuts, too many for her alien-tainted physiology to help. Her eyes were swollen shut, her nose broken. Squares of skin were missing from her shoulders and thighs, and yet she spoke through her broken teeth and hurts with nobility. Thracian felt the first stirrings of sympathy. He squashed them.
"You are tainted," said Thracian.
"I am as human as you are, my lord," she said.
"You are not human, not anymore," said Thracian.
The confessor's hands flexed around his instruments. He was one of two chaplains left alive after the rebellion. He did his duty enthusiastically.
"You are tainted by alien influence. I should have seen it."
Hannelore chuckled. She shook her head. A line of bloody spittle ran from her split lips.
"I am human. More human than you, who resorts to torture. It is not I."
"It should not be possible. There are 49 separate genetic and mental tests all higher servants must undergo. How did you cheat them?"
"Thracian, I cheated nothing," said Hannelore. "I serve the Emperor."
"A false Emperor. An alien perversion of our master's image."
"He is the true Emperor, Thracian. He loves us all. He is coming to save us. I was trying to save you."
"Tell me how you did it."
Hannelore smiled sadly.
Do you really think it is as easy as asking me? You must try harder than that.
Thracian nodded to the confessor. The chaplain strode forwards, pushed Hannelore's head forwards, and applied a pain spike to her neural port. Hannelore's body locked rigid as her nervous system was turned against her. Her feet drummed on the floor, her arms strained until they creaked, her broken teeth ground under the pressure of her own jaw.
Enough, said Thracian.
Hannelore slumped forwards.
Tell me how you did it.
Hannelore lifted her head weakly.
I did not do it. Do you think I could have done these things alone?
She leaned forwards against her bonds. Her voice became a hiss.
It took centuries. The Sky Father came and planted his seed. We grew into a loyal tribe. First, the people of Sotha were shown the light, so that the truth might be spread among them. This took decades. Then, when the brothers and sisters of the Sky Father's family were high enough in the planet's hierarchy, brothers of the family were introduced into the fleet.
Hannelore chuckled.
You held your human subjects in such high regard. You entrusted them with far too much. I was ignorant once, like you. They came to me when I was made an officer. They came from the depths of the ship and gave me the kiss of enlightenment.
Thracian looked to the confessor.
Mutational rate in her gene code suggests she was infected directly 4 years ago.
Then how did she pass the later screenings?
They were carried out on board, said the confessor. The tests were cheated. This strain of gene stealer exhibits extreme talent for psychic subjugation. They have evolved to coexist with us.
So you filled our world and ships with enslaved kin to the Xenos monsters.
How many times must I repeat myself?
Said Hannelore.
We are pure. We are the chosen of the Emperor. He will come and take us and keep us at his side. Do you not see? We do this for you.
Again, Thracian said.
At the confessor's command, pain coursed through Hannelore's system. She screamed. Her altered body was failing under the strain. Thracian raised a hand. The confessor deactivated the pain device. Thracian crouched and pulled back Hannelore's head.
How is it done? Said Thracian quickly. The traitor was deteriorating. How did you hide yourselves from us?
Hannelore's teeth chattered. Snot ran from her nose.
Decades more. All it took was one family member in the right position. Only when the officer cadre of the fleet and Sotharan defense forces were in hand did we attempt to influence the chapter. Our father is mighty, more powerful even than you. We are the chosen ones. We will lead you all to the Emperor's side, even you. It is your destiny. Free me. Let me take up my burden again. Be saved, brother. Salvation is all we have tried to achieve.
No, said Thracian. How many blasphemies against our creed were committed? How could we have been so blind?
Because the Emperor willed it,
said Hannelore.
You hid in plain sight. I pieced enough together myself. I thought Hadrios was trying to corrupt us. He misled us, but not deliberately. It was because of your manipulation. It was you, the people we protected. You destroyed the gene stocks. All those recruits we took after the fall of Sotha, all wasted. Your elders, he spat the word. They enslaved Thorsera's mind. How many are you? How long has this been going on? Said Thracian.
Centuries,
said Hannelore triumphantly.
The family cannot be stopped. You know it. You saw it at the Myral Prime, didn't you? Brothers who would not strike, psychers who could see the glory of the true Emperor. They were enlightened. You felt it at the fall of the monastery. You felt the touch of the true Emperor yourself. We cannot be stopped.
Your psychic tricks will work no more. Thracian stood over his captive. You have been stopped. You do not take into account the will of the Emperor of Mankind, the true Emperor. I am his appointed champion, no matter what influence your vile masters sought to impose on me. You are a Xenos abomination, and you have failed. Save your pity for yourself.
You are so close to salvation, and you do not understand.
It is you who is deluded, Thracian shouted. Your Skyfathers are predators come to feast. They run alongside the swarms. They are tyrannids. Can you not throw off their influence long enough to see?
Sotha was a test to judge if we are worthy.
She had said this many times, always with such utter unshakable conviction. Hannelore smiled sorrowfully.
You shall die with all the others who do not believe. But take heart. All will be saved. All it takes is one of them, and the gospel spreads again. The four-armed emperor, the true lord of humanity. He loves you, and he is coming.
You will die now. I am sorry for you, but I do this gladly.
You could not shoot me before. You know in your heart what I say is true. One day, when you face one of them, you will see the glory.
Hannelore smiled beatifically.
I am the last true child of Sotha, and the messiah of the Emperor.
I am not going to kill you, said Thracian. He gestured at the confessor.
A knife flashed and speared up into Hannelore's brain. The traitor died with her convictions intact and a smile on her face. That was more than Thracian could claim. Past dissolved into present. Fresh wounds became old scars. Now. The Genestealer Patriarch advanced on him, huge, bloated, and unstoppable. Thracian raised his gun and found again that he could not fire. The monster stopped in front of him. Blood dripped from every one of its claws. It panted lightly with the exertion of combat. If he didn't know any better, he would have said it was smiling, but the beast was surely incapable of emotion. The upward curve of its mouth was the result of its abominable physiology. The look of triumph in its eyes was an illusion. It had to be. The Xenos were inhuman. The hive mind shared nothing with mankind. Mortis runes sang in his helm. He could not summon enough free will to deactivate them. Their reedy songs tormented him. Galerius, Keltru, Eulus, Aratus, all of them were dead. The Skyfather paced around him, tread heavy and deliberate as that of the bull Fantines that had inhabited the forests beyond the Pharos. It huffed hot air out and sniffed at him. It held him in psychic thrall. Why by the Emperor did it need to smell him? The Genestealer came back around to the front of Thracian, where he could see it again. It bent low to peer into his eyes. It extended the forefinger of its left hand and gently ran it down the side of Thracian's helm. The nail talon squealed on the ceramite. Its tongue poked out between black teeth. The end was hollow where the ovipositor lurked, waiting to slide out and inject the creature's gene code into another victim and begin the process of subversion again.
I am the last child of Sotha, and I will kill you, said Thracian.
He could barely open his teeth to speak. His muscles clenched in his jaw. His limbs ached from being locked in position. The patriarch's smile appeared to grow wider.
I will kill you. I will kill you. I will kill you, he said.
The patriarch looked at the gun. Then it looked at Thracian. It stepped back and placed its bulbous head against the bolt gun's muzzle. Such a gentle movement for such a monster. Thracian felt the contact as a soft shiver passing up his arm. It twisted its head about on the gun, pushed hard against it. Thracian still could not move and felt himself unbalanced. Abruptly, the Genestealer turned about and strode away. It sat back in its throne.
This is where it all began, said Thracian. I am ending it now. I am ending you now.
The gene stealer steepled its fingers together and folded its upper claw arms across its chest. Inch by torturous inch, Thracian moved the gun away from the gene stealer. It watched him, amused, as his gun came to point at one of the Necron crystals penetrating the floor.
I cannot fire on you, but I can destroy you.
The gene stealer saw Thracian's gambit and was out of its throne swift as lightning, but it was a fraction of a second too late. Its immense bulk slammed into him as Thracian finally forced his finger to contract, sending a salvo of bolts into the crystal. The first and second cracked it. The third blew it apart. The gene stealer bore him down to the ground as he continued firing, spraying the full contents of his magazine out through the room, shattering ancient marble and alien crystal alike. He tumbled over, seeing the scattered remains of his men before being pinned into place by a single enormous hand. The bolter was wrenched from his grasp and hurled across the room. The gene stealer raised its upper claw and punched down, cracking open his breastplate. The three killing talons speared into his chest cavity. He cried out with a pain too great to bear. Blood welled up from his mouth and flooded his helmet. The patriarch stared at him hatefully, cradling his hearts in the vast spread of its claws. There was a rushing noise coming down the corridor, the buzz of grav motors, the rattle of wings, and an enraged hiss. In a final act of defiance, Thracian lifted his head up from the floor, though the effort cost him dearly in pain.
Ave Imperator, he said.
A tide of silver scarab drones engulfed the patriarch, knocking it off Thracian's chest onto the ground. As it fell, it tore out his lungs and his heart, but he lived long enough to see its writhing form become smaller and smaller, until it was gone, consumed by the drones as surely as it had consumed his chapter's world. Having seen his task completed, Thracian allowed himself to rest. Death claimed him, honor and all. Chapter 25. Shards of Greatness. Light poured from the opening sarcophagus, overwhelming Primus's and Felix's autosensors. They were confronted by a sheet of white that caused their battleplate spirits to wail in pain. Then it shrank inwards, becoming a humanoid figure clad in a skin of shining silver, aglow from within. It hovered over them, looking down with an imperious air. The face was hard, angles accentuated more than a human's would be, and the head long, but it was close enough in form that it could have been a child of Terra from Divergent stock, falling somewhere between Eldari and human in look, though its expression was more pitiless than either species.
"What are these?" it said.
Power crackled around it. A terrible heat pounded from its glowing core. Kall's limbs weaved themselves through a complicated curtsy.
"My servants, and therefore your servants. I am no Xenos's slave."
Felix raised his twinned bolters and pointed them at the Catan.
"Silence!"
boomed Zahulash. With a thought, it flipped Felix onto his back and sent him skidding across the floor towards the portal.
"Primus, do something! These creatures are vulnerable to the warp. Use your abilities!"
Felix attempted to stand.
"Be silent!"
The Catan's eyes flashed, and he crashed back down to the ground again. It turned its burning gaze upon Primus.
"You are reckoned strong in the ways of the Soul Sea."
It glowered at Primus, then moved its hand and lifted it, palm upwards. Primus dropped Kall's axe as he began to choke and rose, kicking from the ground. He clutched at his throat.
"Then match yourself against us."
It glared dismissively at Primus.
"Feeble. Even in our weakened state, you cannot oppose us. The power of the warp is nothing to mastery of the physical realm. We were true gods, the living embodiment of this universe. Those of the warp are pale shadows. We are the light."
It roared. Its shining body flared with the stolen power of extinct suns. The chamber trembled in response. The sarcophagi jiggled in the air. One listed, turning aside, falling down slowly.
"We are Zahulash, the Potentate."
It gestured, and a bladed rod flashed into being in its left hand, and a crown blurred into existence over its head, both made of the same silvery metal caging the Catan's light.
We are a lord of space and time. We are a manifestation of reality's living soul.
It gestured again, and Primus was flung backwards. His armor crashed against the portal housing, and he fell heavily to the floor. He too attempted to rise, but the Catan flattened him with a twitch of its finger, pushing down like a man squashing an insect. Primus was crushed onto the ground. His armor began to creak under the pressure. Call moved forwards.
Master, please, I beg you not to kill Primus. He is a loyal slave, and will serve you as faithfully as he serves me. You can swear this. I swear it. He cannot disobey me. And this other? Also my creation. Spare them both. We shall need them in the chambers beyond. There are many millions of your jailer's constructs beyond this gate. They will not be able to stop us.
The Catan smiled sadistically and pushed hard. A conduit in Primus's armor burst. White gas jetted out.
Witness our might. They will try. Spare them.
The Catan pulled a sour expression.
If you insist.
Its finger curled back into its fist. Primus took in a desperate breath. He and Felix staggered to their feet.
Know this, slaves of Slave Call. The energy that makes up your beings is ours to command. Move against us, and we shall destroy you utterly. Slave Call, you will escort us through the portal and deactivate the things of the Necrontyr. Beyond is the principal machine room of this facility. There, you will free us from this form. We shall open a portal and step forward into the stars to reclaim our birthright and drive lesser beings before us into death.
Call bowed humbly.
Yes, my master, he said,
and scuttled forwards to the portal. He linked himself with it, activating its destination patterns. Glyphs ignited around the triangular aperture, and the energy it held swirled in agitation.
I have deactivated the safety protocols against your departure. It is safe for you to pass, O Great One,
Call proclaimed.
Good.
Zaholash pointed the end of its staff at the portal, and with a swift tug backwards, pulled the energy field towards itself out of the gate and into the air, where it spread and reformed into a rift wide enough to allow the Catan out.
Tremble, O ye nations of the galaxy, for Zaholash the Potentate walks again amongst you.
With those words, the Catan's form dissolved into a streak of silver-braided light, and it poured into and through the gate. The portal flexed back into its frame. All energy seemed to be sucked from the chamber with its passing. The sarcophagi fell from their station in the air with mighty crashes, and the space began to pulse, shrinking inwards. A violent strobing began at what appeared like some miles' distance, but it came closer, and the bursts of light multiplied.
Aha! Said Call. Just as I thought. The heart of the mountain is contained within a dimensional pocket.
He grinned over his mouthguard at Felix.
I knew that. But, he said, the contents are unraveling. Come on, my boys, we must leave this place, now!
He went to retrieve his axe. Felix staggered towards the gate. The flashing dazzled him. Gravity waves pounded at them, dragging them away from the portal, but he set himself against them and, with his armor systems pushed past their operating tolerances, strove for the gate. Call clattered past him, esoteric field projectors shielding him from the forces tearing apart the false space of the sarcophagus chamber.
Remember what I told you, he said to Felix. No shooting.
Whatever was happening in the chamber of the sarcophagi affected the mountain far more badly. The hall containing the deep core mine was shaking. Fountains of liquid rock burst in fiery display. Chunks of blackstone plummeted to the ground, shattering like dropped glass. The temple facade trembled and cracked. The drone swarm was agitated, buzzing loudly, swelling and shrinking in a great metallic flock. Long tendrils composed of thousands of drones reached out to gather up the broken shards of the mountain, or squirmed over the cracks appearing in the wall, fighting a losing battle to repair them as they formed. Their mouthparts sparkled with desperate activity. The mountain quaked. Falls of stone roared down far tunnels, and the many pipes of its internal structure wailed in alarm.
The bridge between our extra-dimensional cell and this facility must be severed, Zahulash intoned. Following this, the canoptic devices must be brought under control, Zahulash said, pointing imperiously towards the swarm. Only they have the ability to strip the necrodermis from our true energy form and free us. You have the way into the machine's mind, Slave Call. Use it. Once we are free, we will have little time before the mountain destroys itself and this world.
Without waiting for confirmation, Zahulash floated towards the swarm of scarabs. It let out a blazing pulse of light. The scarabs appeared blind to its presence until the light washed over the Catan. But the moment they became aware of it, their behavior changed utterly. The swarm froze instantly.